From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a conversation about Watergate and the presidency with Leon Neyfog, host of the Slow Burn podcast.
It didn't occur to me that there were this many, there were as many sort of intriguing subplots and as many characters that I wasn't even remotely aware of.
Later, Milwaukee Magazine explores some of Wisconsin's most intriguing unsolved mysteries.
They sort of have percolated through the public consciousness for a long time.
The organization Teens Grow Greens moves into a new home.
Plus, actor and playwright Steve Sciante talks about the inspiration for his one-man show, Hear What's in the Heart.
I would talk about Middletown growing up in Connecticut, talking about my grandfather and the neighborhood pizza guy, and I would have my acting teacher cracking up.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. The first season of the Slow Burn podcast, produced by the online magazine Slate, told an eight-part true story of political dirty tricks, scandal, and a president who would seemingly say anything to cover his tracks and stay in office. But if you thought it was a current events podcast, you'd be mistaken. The events Slow Burn describes happened 45 years ago. It was the Watergate scandal that brought down President Richard Nixon.
What happens when the president uses the machinery the government to protect himself against an outside threat? And what does it feel like when you are that threat and the most powerful person in the country shuts you down? This is Slow Burn, a podcast about Watergate. I'm your host, Leon Neyfog.
A lot of hard words were traded in Washington.
Journalist Leon Neyfog was the reporter behind Slow Burn, and he sought to relate some of the many stories of Watergate that have been all but lost over time and portray what it was like to experience that political scandal in real time. I spoke with Leon Neyfog in front of a live audience at UW-Milwaukee last week, and we'll hear some of that conversation on today's show. Leon Neyfog, welcome to Milwaukee. So I'm wondering, as the reporter on this series, whether you came out of it with the same feeling that I did as a listener, the somewhat odd feeling that I wish the crisis had gone on longer.
we did eight episodes, and towards the end, I felt like we were rushing through a lot of good stuff, and I almost wish that we could have done 12 or something, so that we could have slowed down a little bit and chewed on it a little bit longer. Because it did feel like we were sort of tumbling down a hill as the impeachment inquiry heated up, and we could have spent a little more time on it, I think.
It's like that phenomenon in history class where you spend all this time in the Civil War and Reconstruction, and then like the last two classes you do the entire 20th century.
That's right. Well, when I started working on this, I rewatched all the President's Men just to like remind myself of what it was I already vaguely knew about Watergate and what other people might be expected to know. And I was astonished to realize that the actual film covers the first like 5.5-6 months of the story. And then the entire, you know, I think like another year and a half gets montaged through a bunch of newspaper headlines in the way that you just described.
Right. So how well-versed did you think you were on Watergate when you went into this process?
I did not think I was well-versed, but it didn't occur to me that there were this many, there were as many sort of intriguing subplots and as many characters that I wasn't even remotely aware of. As it turned out, there are. I kind of was skeptical initially when my editors wanted to undertake this project because I felt like this is a pretty familiar story. People know there was a break-in at the DNC. People know that it was controversial, and people know that he was forced out of office because of it. How much more could there be to it? And so it was when I read the story of Martha Mitchell that my eyes were opened to all the really delightful details and sort of peripheral characters that I learned about over the course of my research.
Well, you just brought up an interesting point a minute ago. You went back and watched All the President's Men, and you make the point in the series a couple of times that not only is it the Woodward and Bernstein version of Watergate that really dominates the public consciousness 45 years later, but it's really the movie version of the Woodward and Bernstein story. What did you learn in doing this series about how some accounts get to be history of record while others get to be forgotten, more or less?
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's a totally fascinating question. We did a live show in New York about 2 weeks ago, and that was actually the exact theme of the night. I don't really have a great answer. With All the President's Men, I mean, I think it probably helps that it was a great film. It helps that Robert Redford was in it. Bob Woodward was one of the guests at our event, and I asked him what it's been like to be sort of Mr. Watergate, to be responsible for like the dominant version of the story when, you know, a lot of the chapters of the story have nothing to do with journalism. You know, there's a chapter about the Senate. There's a chapter about the House. There's a chapter about the Special Prosecutor's Office. All of these different kind of institutions had to function in order for the story to go the way it did. And for the most part, those aren't really in the Woodward and Bernstein version because, why should it be? I mean, they were telling their story, right? Their book is about their reporting process. But it's not just a story about journalism. And so I believe the best thing he said was, well, what has it been like? I've disappointed a lot of women, meaning doesn't look quite like Robert Redford, which took me a second on stage. It took me a second too long before I could laugh.
You, a few seconds ago, changed a verb tense from are to were when you were talking about the characters. But there is something significant to this story in that not all, but many of the people in the orbit of Watergate are still alive and are still, I don't know, happy to talk about that period?
Yeah, well, so you said still. I don't know if still is the right word or if it's the opposite, where they're like, I'm like 85. I might as well talk about this now. we had people that we interviewed who were really, really eager to sort of relive this part of their lives because it was an extremely important part of who they became. And a lot of these people were amazingly like in their 20s and 30s when they were, you know, working for the Senate Investigative Committee, when they were working for the House when the impeachment probe was underway. The whole like staff of the Special Prosecutor's Office were these kids in their late 20s, early 30s, fresh out of law school, who were hanging out together drinking when they weren't, you know, collecting evidence on Nixon's obstruction of justice.
You can almost imagine it being an Aaron Sorkin series.
You could imagine that. I wish someone more important than me could imagine it.
What were to you the biggest challenges in trying to tell this story in that sort of real-time fashion 4 decades after it happened?
So the hardest part, I think, was sort of finding the right individuals to tell each part of the story, right? So we, you know, our first move in kind of after we'd sort of done our preliminary research was to try to outline this story and try to divided into chunks. We knew we wanted to do 8 episodes. I'm not really sure how we decided on 8, but we knew 8 was the number. And so, you know, the first challenge was to try to figure out where each one would start and they would end. And then sort of try to find conceptual questions that each one could be focused on. So like episode 3 was about why it took so long for the American people to start caring about Watergate and to become interested in it and become concerned that the president had done all these things. Nixon won by a massive landslide in 1972, despite the fact that, you know, all those stories that we see being reported out in All the President's Men were already published. And even though Walter Cronkite had, you know, put on an unprecedented special on the news about all the connections between these burglars and the White House. And it was sort of triangulating between, like, we got to get from here to here in the timeline, and we got to find the right characters who will allow us to tell that part of the story and like allow us to explore these sort of thematic questions that we wanted each episode to be about.
Yeah, well, and the thing that really strikes me is that the number of, you know, kind of authors and historians that assist you in telling the story is pretty low. This is not a Ken Burns series.
Yeah, I think we tried to keep it pretty light on secondary sources. I think we have like probably between 1 and 2 and 3 in each episode. The best use of, I think, secondary sources was in this series was when you had someone who was an expert on something very narrow. We had a historian who just knows everything about Wright Patman. She wrote a book about Wright Patman, and so it was just great to be able to have her sort of ransack her research, for us, and then tell us everything she knows about it. But we also interviewed someone, people like Rick Perlstein, who has written extensively and broadly about Nixon and the conservative movement in general. I think we always wanted to use people who were there when we could, and then use historians to sort of give us the scaffolding of sort of like what is the significance of it, not so much narrate the stories, which we wanted to leave to the individuals who lived through them.
You bring up Wright Patman. You also make a really interesting comparison in the first episode of the show about Martha Mitchell. You compare her to Anthony Scaramucci, mm-hmm. Who was White House communications director for like 25 minutes last summer.
That's right.
But the point you make is that for every huge story, there are these people who are briefly important players, Wright Patman, Martha Mitchell, any number of people in the series, who are largely forgotten, except in maybe really difficult trivia competitions.
Right.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, otherwise we get the, to be able to tell any history, we're hit with the information fire hose.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a necessary process, sort of. I'm reaching for the metaphor. What's the thing that you use to... Sifting. There you go. Thank you. I think in 45 years, like, who are going to... And I've wondered this, like, who will be the characters in the drama that's currently unfolding that will be remembered? It's funny you mentioned, Anthony Scaramucci was my comparison point for Martha Mitchell, not because they were both, got in trouble for talking to reporters, though it turned out they have that in common as well. But because they do both seem like sort of peripheral, in the same way. But then more recently, a guy whose name I had to work very hard 10 seconds ago to remember, Sam Nunberg, who was like a friend of Trump's, possibly a lawyer of Trump's, I don't even remember, went on television, drunk, and said all kinds of things he wasn't supposed to say, and suddenly he was the Martha Mitchell of the current crisis, and I'll be really interested to see who are the sort of lasting figures, because I think this is the story that we're seeing now is like just seems almost exclusively populated by minor characters. Like there's one major character, and everybody else is sort of in his orbit.
It's kind of the way he likes it, though.
Exactly. No, I think it's quite by design.
One of the other things that occurred to me in listening to the full series that I had never really known before is that there were really actually, and maybe they were minor players, but there were a lot more women in the orbit of Watergate than we've been led to believe. And maybe that's because that's the way history has often been told through the years. But, it's not something that comes out in most stories of Watergate.
Yeah, it was something that we were happy to see happen when we noticed it in our writing and reporting. It wasn't something we, deliberately set out to do, but I do think it's sort of a natural result of trying to find unexplored angles and trying to find I get self-conscious calling them characters because they're real people, but in our search for sort of underappreciated or under-remembered characters, it's not that surprising that more of them turn out to be women. But it was a happy sort of byproduct of our broader mission to try to find fresh ways into this rather familiar story.
Now, you had always worked in print before this project,
yep.
Aside from this music video you were telling me about as we sat here. So sound would not necessarily have mattered, but in addition to the audio interviews you did for the series, talk about your impressions of some of the archival sound that you used to illustrate it.
Well, I've been thinking about this a little bit lately because I'm currently working on what will be season 2 of Slow Burn about the Clinton years, and I'm realizing as I'm kind of working with the archival footage that I can't expect it to be as transporting as the stuff that we used in this show, because it just sounds a lot more similar to what we are used to hearing. Like, TV from the 90s doesn't sound that different from TV in 2018. The intro music for, the evening news is a little more brassy and a little more dramatic maybe than it is now, but to the point where you can kind of date it. But the way that people talk, the way they sound, the way the recording sounds, you can't date it as precisely as when you hear John Chancellor speaking, as an NBC anchor, both in terms of how the recording sounds and in terms of his, accent's the wrong word, but just his dialect. And you could think of it in retrospect as like a crutch. I mean, it was so instantly transporting to hear some of this tape. Sorry.
Go back to John Chancellor for a second, because I know some people have kind of described him as the co-narrator in this series.
That's right,
what did having
yes.
John Chancellor's voice throughout the series mean for it?
Well, there's a reason that we used a lot of John Chancellor, which is not a sexy reason. And that reason is that we got a great licensing deal with NBC that allowed us to use him, and other networks were less generous, and so we used less of them. But at the same time, it was also, again, a happy kind of byproduct in that he did feel like a presence throughout, and it was cool to hear him sound a little bit different based on what was happening. So in most of the recordings that you hear in the season, rather in the show, he sounds calm, like he's just the kind of inveterate newsman who is steady and dispassionate. And then the tape of him reacting to the Saturday Night Massacre, he is shaken, and you can tell he's shaken. And it just sort of spoke to how wild that moment was. And I think if you heard just that out of context, you might not necessarily appreciate it. So I was happy to have him as my co-pilot.
Well, and you bring up the idea that dialect has kind of changed. And it hasn't been chronologically all that many years, but you listen to the politicians of the era talk, and their speaking style is completely different than what we are used to hearing from politicians today.
Yeah, I mean, especially Nixon, who, as we were discussing before the show, had such a distinctive way of speaking, and just a total wonder that he became president, given how strange he was and how socially clumsy and just awkward he was. You think to be the most powerful politician in the country, you have to have a little finesse.
There are clearly a lot of parallels people can draw between Watergate and the current state of presidential politics, but you never really belabor that in the course of this series. I mean, you bring it up at the beginning and at the end of the series explicitly, but were you trying consciously to give Watergate its own breathing room?
I would say we were obviously aware of the parallels that listeners were also aware of. But we didn't deliberately run towards them. We didn't deliberately seek them out. And I wasn't necessarily expecting them. Like, we obviously started doing this because of the current political situation and because we felt like there was a broad parallel in the sense that here was a period of time in American history when the country's political situation or the functioning of the government felt very precarious. And when a period of time when people were waking up in the morning and not knowing what was going to happen next, and they were reading about things in the newspaper that had never happened before. And what did that feel like? And did it feel similar to the way we feel now? And, that's obviously a premise in which the idea of parallels is sort of embedded. But we did not expect the level of sort of just like the specificity of the parallels that we ended up finding. I mean, my favorite, and this is actually an example of one where I did kind of write towards it a little bit because I did, it was just sort of too good to leave on the cutting room floor. But so at a certain point, Nixon was being pressured to release more tapes. He'd released some tapes to the special prosecutor. He had to release more, or he was being asked to release more. And he, once again, tried to compromise by publishing. They did, in fact, publish official government, printed government printing office editions of this, thousands of pages of transcripts of Oval Office tapes that again had been edited, and he said they were edited. He said, we've taken out national security stuff, we've taken out irrelevant stuff, but the important things are here, and there's plenty of embarrassing stuff in here. What he didn't think about was that by that point, some of the conversations that were reflected in those transcripts had been subpoenaed and had been actually handed over to the impeachment inquiry. And so there were members of the House who had listened to the tapes that were represented in these transcripts. And so they saw these transcripts, and they went back to their notes on the tapes they'd listened to, and they were like, wait, there are major things missing here. There are entire passages where Nixon all but says, I did a crime, that aren't here. And so they leaked it. They leaked those discrepancies to the press. And Pat Buchanan, then working as a sort of speechwriter slash spokesman slash advisor to Nixon, went out to the press and said, you journalists should be looking at the real story, which is these leaks. You know, how can you, you know, you got to figure out who these leakers are. And so, gosh, you know, that just, you know, it could have happened yesterday, or you could have read the same quote yesterday from Pat Buchanan, in fact. So in that case, I did sort of deliberately include, it's not an important moment in the story of Watergate, but it was kind of delightful. So
you come out of doing this series with a palpable sense of hope. And I was hoping that you might elaborate a little bit on why reporting for as long as you did on Watergate leaves you with a sense of hope today.
Well, I don't know how hopeful I am. I think insofar as it did make me hopeful to learn the details of this story, there were just so many people who stood up and kind of acted and took initiative in whatever ways they could, whether they were members of, you know, the Senate Watergate Committee, or whether they were just little 25-year-old lawyers who worked for the senators in the Senate Watergate Committee. There were a lot of people who did their jobs, and as a result, the institutions that they were part of kind of played their proper function, played their proper role. You don't play a function.
Served their proper function.
Thank you. There you go. And so that makes me hopeful. I feel like people are motivated to you know, insofar as there's wrongdoing to be uncovered, people are motivated to uncover it right now. And on the other hand, it did also feel to me, though, as though the ending of Watergate was in no way inevitable. Like it was the result of, again, many different people doing, you know, taking initiative. And if they hadn't, and if things hadn't broken a certain way, then it might have ended a very different way. In some cases, it wasn't about anyone taking initiative. It was about people making stupid decisions, like Nixon deciding to tape himself committing crimes. A misfire that I think determined the course of the story as much as anything else. You know, the fact that there was a John Dean, that the guy, you know, a White House counsel who was willing to testify in the way he did, and there could have not been one, you know, and who knows how it would have turned out if there hadn't been.
Well, I just have to say, you and your colleagues have done an amazing thing with this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here.
Leon Nafok is a reporter for Slate and the voice of the Slow Burn podcast about Watergate. Nafok was born in Moscow but grew up in the Chicago area. We spoke with him in an event last week, co-sponsored by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Center for 21st Century Studies.
Why President Nixon was involved in bugging the DNC is still a mystery. We'll talk about some Wisconsin-centric mysteries when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Many of us like a good mystery. The May issue of Milwaukee Magazine is chock full of real-life mysteries with a decided local flair. The magazine's cover story relates a handful of unsolved mysteries and hidden history from around Wisconsin.
Senior editor Matt Rohde was the guiding force behind the series of features, and he joins us now and explains when it dawned on him that there were so many offbeat mysteries in this state.
They sort of have percolated through the public consciousness for a long time. I mean, a lot of people know about the Haunchyville story, that there's this secret village for small people somewhere in the metro area.
All right, maybe, but maybe not everybody knows that story. So why don't you tell that story?
Right. I mean, it's a legend. I think it goes back decades, and it's sort of, there's no real, not much space left for it to exist anymore because of development. But there used to be a wooded area in Muskego close to Mystic Drive where it was believed that there was some kind of village that was hidden away where small people perhaps escaped from the circus were living. And there's this guy who's an albino who carried a shotgun and would scare people off who came to investigate, which were often 17-year-old kids
right.
with driver's licenses or older people who had a late night. And there were some small structures there off and on, but they don't really exist anymore. And the woods that are there now are pretty small. I don't know what the exact acreage is, but you can almost see from one end of it to the other. So it would have to be.
And there
are
no reports of developers going in there to build things and encountering this village.
Right. Nobody got chased out.
You kind of cast a wide net. These are not all Milwaukee. There are some in other parts of the state as far out as Madison, I think. And in fact, let's talk about one of these mysteries from Madison. What do we know about the case of the cross-dressing corpse?
Yeah, that's quite a legend. It's not even a legend. It's an unsolved mystery from the Madison area. There's a music store north of Madison, might still be within the city limits, called Good and Loud. And in 1989, somebody was sweeping around in the basement, and they pulled out some part of the furnace, and behind that they found a corpse wearing a dress and women's shoes, and there were some other articles. And police never were 90% sure that it was actually a man. According to the autopsy, this guy could have died a couple months ago, a couple weeks, a couple years. Just nobody, it was never narrowed down. It's always just been a mystery who this guy was. And one of the weird things about it is the chimney is less than a foot in diameter. So somehow this guy either fell or got crammed into this lower area. So
he either got stuck there or was intentionally placed there.
Right. Yeah. It could have been a burglary is one of the theories. And he was dressed in the way he was as a disguise. Or the police early on put out the idea that maybe he was meeting up with someone there who's expecting to meet a woman, but this didn't go as planned. And so the guy, out of some kind of fit of rage or something, murdered him. And then I guess he would have dragged him up onto the roof. So no particular story just kind of makes complete sense for how this guy got to be where he was.
Well, apparently there's a contact at the Madison Police Department who specializes in cold cases. Do you get the sense, is he actively working on cases like this, or is there really just a guy who's the keeper of the files, and if a lead comes in, he matches it up with things that he's keeping track of?
It didn't sound like they were actively working on this now.
Yeah.
And it got handed over to the FBI at some point, and I was told that they pushed it as far as they could, and that was sort of the end of it. And there was a cast in at one point of what the man's face may have looked like, hoping that would generate leads. Didn't really work, except for one woman thought it looked like a State House page she had known, but
she couldn't remember the guy's name.
So, yeah. And as wishy-washy as face recognition can be, it's who even knows.
Especially circa 1989.
Right, yeah.
All right, so let's go closer to home. Apparently, trailer loads of cheese are something people steal.
There was a rash of it a couple years ago. In 2016, there were a couple of cases. One was valued about $70,000.
A lot of cheese.
Yeah, right. And cargo theft is a thing that happens where you somehow get hitched up to somebody else's trailer and take off with it. But it's tricky because all of a sudden you've got $70,000 worth of one kind of cheese on your hands to unload over the next before it spoils.
Right. This is not like something you can pull over in a parking lot and sell pants out of your trunk.
Right. For the next 10 years.
Yeah.
and even if you manage to steal a trailer full of tablets or something, I mean, that's still difficult to get rid of. But yeah, so there's this couple guys from Milwaukee who stole a tractor trailer. Then they took it to a refrigerated warehouse place and got hooked up to a trailer full of different kinds of cheese. And they had been in contact with a grocery store in the city, and they sold it to him, but it ultimately ended up just being destroyed, I think, because for whatever reason. Then the police were able to backtrack to the guys who stole it from the owner. And the
tractor had a GPS tracking device on it anyway, right, as well. So that was a solved cheese mystery. But then there's another trailer that just disappeared, right?
Yeah, there was one on the south side that just some guy had parked it and went run an errand or something, and somebody slipped in behind. And I guess somebody had been watching this little parking lot area and just went in and grabbed it.
Interesting. So anybody listening has encountered a trailer full of cheese. maybe this is the one. I wanted to ask you, we go out to Rock Lake in Jefferson County, which apparently is home to some either suspicious landforms or suspicious something else under its surface. What's the story of the alleged underwater pyramids?
Yeah, this is one of the more conflicted stories that we looked at. I mean, mainstream archaeology says, yeah, we just really don't think so. a lot of people of an academic background, of some kind of expert background, have been involved over the years with different groups that have tried to finally uncover the truth. And, yeah, there's always this just enough of a trickle of evidence that comes out of, well, that does look kind of weird. It's like, well, yeah. And
they've used sonar on this lake to try to map the bottom of it, and there does look like something down there.
Yeah, that's kind of the latest wave. Yeah.
Good lake reference there.
Right. Sure. Yeah, and a famous Wisconsin diver, Max Noel, went down early on and saw some things. He saw something that looked like an upside down ice cream cone, which got
only larger, probably.
Right, and that was worth about 50 years of speculation. And
right, he did this in the 30s.
Yeah. A lot of it happens because the lake itself is pretty murky. It's a bit silty, and so it's hard to completely rule stuff out that you can't see. And it's hard for divers to return to the same spot that they had been in before. They say that it's left over from a rock pile left over from the glaciers, and you can find it in lakes all over the state. It's not that unusual. And the prevailing pyramid is sort of shaped like a tent, like an army tent, where it's long and triangular. And, yeah.
So has anybody checked to see if there is a village of little people inside it?
No. Little mermaids, no.
I wanted to ask you about one other mystery, which maybe it's not a mystery. Maybe it's just a curiosity. But the picture really kind of intrigues me. This is Oak Creek's Road to Nowhere. This is a road that it doesn't really stop. There's just a barricade keeping people from going down the rest of the way, because if they continued the rest of the way, they would go down a lot further.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there used to be no barricade, and there's an accident or two, and now there's a barricade. And it's a place sort of like the Hotchieville area where it's 11 o'clock at night and people feel a wanderlust, and they decided to go check it out. People seem to have as many supernatural type experiences there as they do car accidents these days. As people walk up and they see strange ghosts and spirits. But during the daylight hours, there are people walking their dogs and such. And it's right next to a very nice park. So,
And this is a road that just beyond the concrete barrier goes for, what, a half mile or so?
Yeah, it's about a half a mile, and then it just very abruptly stops. It's kind of hard to explain, like, why. I'm sure
why they built it.
Yeah. And
this is where the bridge over Lake Michigan was going.
Right, yeah. And, yeah, it's as if erosion had knocked off what was supposed to be the original end of the road. If you stop by, there's always cars out there, people who are enjoying it or looking to have something mysterious happen.
Like perhaps encounter the angry goat man.
Oh, yeah, the goat man.
Who would be, he would be well out of his territory if he were hanging out in Oak Creek.
He shows up in a lot of places. He's kind of a folk character. And this author from Washington County, J. Nathan Couch, who thought of him as such and had researched him pretty extensively and traveled to different parts of the country, I think. And he was seeing it as this was a manifestation of some kind of like Jungian or archetype in the psyche, until he talked to a hunter who had been hunting in the Kewaskum area when one of these things showed up out of nowhere, and it was pretty unmistakable. And he's referred to as the angry goat man, at least in our case, because he was fuming under his breath about trespassers. And so the guy took off pretty quick.
Any other great stories that you uncovered as part of this series of stories?
I found a number of cases of cemeteries that had been moved from one place to the other throughout town. And it turns out that the business of cemeteries isn't always as neat and tidy as one may think. And sometimes they get stacked up one, two, three bodies on top of another. Sometimes they get moved. And then when they get moved and they're very old, they're not good records necessarily about where the bodies are. So you end up with a bunch that are just left behind. So yeah, no, these are pretty dense areas of the cities nowadays. So you've got bodies just kind of tucked into the margins and that you don't even realize that are there, that have just been lost to time.
And then one day somebody is digging and all of a sudden unearths this cache of bodies.
Right. Yeah, it happens all the time. And that can complicate things immensely for whoever's project that is. Yeah, so they're out there.
All right. Matt Rohde, thanks.
Thank you.
Matt Rohde is senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine. The Unsolved Mysteries series is the cover story in the May issue.
Another break now, and then the story of the rebirth of a shuttered greenhouse on the north side of Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. A new old business is about to come to life. Let us explain. In 1931, Weber's Greenhouses opened on Green Bay Avenue north of Capitol Drive. 2 years ago, it closed, but starting this weekend, it will get new life.
Weber's is becoming a greenhouse and experiential learning headquarters to an internship program called Teens Grow Greens. Lake Effect's Susan Bentz stopped in as the revitalization was still underway. We'll learn more about Teens Grow Greens, but first we'll meet the nursery manager.
I sell some like bagged compost.
Claire Musa stands amidst a sea of sprouting plants.
So this is our tomato house. We have heirloom tomatoes on this side.
It's one of four greenhouses in which everything from begonias to zucchini will take root. But this structure is Musa's favorite.
You know, one of like the biggest struggles is dragging a hose around. Especially if you have customers around and you have to like, oh, sorry, watch your step. And, you know, there's always like a leak somewhere. There's always like a giant spray of water coming out. But whoever had built this greenhouse was like very innovative, ran a cable across the ceiling, and now the hose is hung up high. And so it's completely in no one's way at any point in time, which is like, to me, the most like, it's the smartest thing. It's the smartest thing. I wish I had invented it.
Before she took on the job of nursery manager for Teens Grow Green's new headquarters, Musa ran her own vintage clothing business. But it doesn't take long to realize that plants and soil run deep in the woman. Her first job as a teenager.
First job was in a greenhouse, and I got that job because my mom worked in a greenhouse. She worked in a greenhouse my whole life. We had vegetable gardens there for as long as I can remember, every year.
And her mom has been helping her with some of the early planting here.
My mom volunteers at least once a week. She helped me clean out that garage. She helped plant some of these tomatoes. She seeded some stuff with us. Yeah, she's addicted just like I am.
Of course, there's a bigger story to be told. 5 years ago, it was here at Weber's Greenhouses that Charlie Eline tested his theory that teens could grow their organizational and leadership skills while learning what it means to grow plants from seed to splendor. Year one, Eline nurtured 10 teens here. This season, there are 18.
You know, one of the first things that attracted me to Weber's was that it had a great customer base, a diverse customer base for Milwaukee. And, you know, it always occurred to me that they were growing more than plants here, that people were coming in here to, you know, continue their traditions of growing plants and then feeding their family, or they were picking up flowers to brighten their home or, you know, remember loved ones. And the great thing about this is that this isn't only this generation that is going to come back to Weber's to do that sort of thing, but it's the previous generations as well. And how many places can you say have that sort of history?
Weber's closed 2 years ago. Eline then got the opportunity to buy the business and keep the tradition alive. The teens will only be spending part of their time here, however. They're growing crops at two different garden locations.
It's hard to develop leadership by just doing worksheets and talking about it. You need to do leadership. The ways that we've found to actually have the teens experience leadership is that the teens will mentor third, fourth, and fifth graders in the garden in basically everything they've learned in the past months of the internship. How to grow food, how to cook food, and then how to set goals and build certain skills and characteristics. So the teens are actually leading that program, which is called Kids Grow Greens, during the summer.
Teens split their time between gardening, mentoring, and staffing three farmers markets 3 days a week. But there's more. In August, the teens dive into the individualized entrepreneurship program. Graduates of Teens Grow Greens have developed everything from a terrarium business featuring succulent plants to lip balm and dog treats.
A great example of the entrepreneurship unit is Trayvon, who's a graduate and now he's on staff. He's going to set up his cafe for his product, which is called Joe Veggie Go, a mixture of all natural juices and coffee. Trayvon, I hope I got that right. And he will have that pop-up cafe right at Weber's on specific dates.
Eline's eyes gleam with the potential of this nearly one-acre parcel and its seven greenhouses.
We want to hear from the community, what else would you like to see? Because we want to continue that tradition of having it be a community business.
Buying the nursery is a big move for Teens Grow Greens. Eline says it will cost $50,000 a year to keep the greenhouses humming, but the plan is to offset that with income the nursery generates.
Make some revenue for the nonprofit as well. So make it into a profitable business.
Manager Claire Musa is ready to do her part, working with the teens and growing plants the public clamors to buy.
I think that's exciting. I think if we can sort of like make that bridge for kids at a younger age, you know, it of course will lead to healthier living.
But at that moment, Musa's focus was on the greenhouse she needs to fill with enticing plants before they officially open for business this Saturday.
Yeah, so this will all be planted today. Then this greenhouse will like officially be full.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
A ribbon cutting?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have just like a...
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. Weber's greenhouses will open to the public this weekend. You can read more about the story and Teens Grow Greens at WUWM.com.
One last break, then we're joined in studio by Anthony Crivello and Steve Schianti from Hear What's in the Heart, now on stage at Next Act Theater. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Steve Schianti's Hear What's in the Heart is a one-man exploration of the Italian-American experience. Schianti is the playwright and sole performer of the show, which documents his experiences growing up in Middletown, Connecticut.
The play is currently on stage at Milwaukee's Next Act Theater. The play first premiered in L.A. in the late 90s, where it first caught the eye of Milwaukee native Anthony Crivello. Now, decades later, he is directing the show in his hometown.
Crivello and Schianti joined me in the studio to talk about the show and its long journey to the Cream City. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a story that is very near and dear to you. What inspired this play?
It was an acting class that I was taking in Los Angeles back in 1994-95. And during our breaks in class, my acting teacher, Mel Shapiro, was a professor emeritus at UCLA's acting program, but he taught acting at Carnegie Mellon, and a bunch of people from Carnegie Mellon, actually one gentleman I did West Side Story with, and he invited me into the company. And during our coffee breaks, I would talk about Middletown growing up in Connecticut, talk about my grandfather and the neighborhood pizza guy, and I would have my acting teacher cracking up, and he goes, "You got to come back in. You got to start doing improv. You have enough material to do a one-man show." And I was like, "Nah, you got to be kidding me." Because it was, you know, pretty scary thing, first time I've ever done anything like that. So I started coming in every week with different characters. And then my friend James at the time came in and said, hey, I would love to help you out. I love the subject matter. He loved Italians for some reason, and he loved the story. So we worked on it for 2 years, and then we had an opening night performance on October 16th, 1997, and Anthony happened to be in the audience. Because I had known Anthony at that point. I met Anthony in 1993, and we were friends for 4 years at that point, and he was in the audience at that time. So that's how it came into his fruition at that time.
Yeah, you saw it more than two decades ago. What was it about this show that really stuck with you?
Same thing. I mean, the themes of the show, which are universal. It is about characters in Steve's life, and it's autobiographical, those characters, because of its family members, its people in the neighborhood. And it was there's a universal wisdoms that are handed down from each one of those different sources. Steve actually does portions of dialogue in Sicilian and translates it immediately on stage. So I'm understanding a little bit of the Sicilian, obviously, and then the English translation as well. And the characters have a universality to them. Like, for instance, there's a guy, Jerry, the pizza man. And Jerry is a very, very funny character. He's a guy that in every single city, you've got a pizza man or a character who is like that. You know, there is his Uncle Amo is a black sheep of the family. And even the black sheep of the family lends tremendous wisdom to Steve in the particular journey. And in this particular story, it's about a man in Steve who was a good high school athlete and then came to a crossroad, whether or not to, at one point, to play baseball for a Xaverian Jesuit priest who was a baseball coach, or to be a bottle dancer and fiddler in the roof, and decided to take the path of going and doing the show. That led to conflict with his compatriots, who were the athletes, and led to fist fights, et cetera. And then finally, him going in and getting wisdom, again, from his grandfather, who also faced a similar crossroad. And his grandfather was always encouraging about Steve following an artistic path and following his dreams. Mm-hmm. So when you have those kinds of central themes, it was, I immediately related to so much of the material. And just in the portrayals, Steve does, there's 8 or 9 central characters, and there's 13 characters in total that he does, portraying all these different ones. And each one is succinct and different. What had happened, we had known each other, and the show had a gestation period and kept going. It was playing some different engagements. And then for a while, the show disappeared. We ran into one another, and I had said to him, whatever happened to the show, your one-man show? So this was a little over 9, almost 10 years ago. We had come across each other again, and Steve had said to me, I would really love it if you would get involved. And I was working at the time in Las Vegas. I was doing Phantom of the Opera in Vegas. And the great thing about that particular happenstance, serendipitously, was that Las Vegas has a setup in its libraries. Almost every single one of the libraries also has a theater connected to it. And so we were able to access via the library system a theater. When we got together, I said, he had a lot of material that was wonderful material, but certain pieces of it just didn't quite string together in my, when I watched it. And I thought, we need a little bit more solid beginning and an ending. Yeah. And so we decided, hey, let's take this, deconstruct and reconstruct the piece again, and just begin to work on it again. And Las Vegas was the launching pad to do that.
Okay. So did you first mount the production in Las Vegas?
Yes.
The newer version of it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When did you make the decision to bring it to Milwaukee?
Ironically,
here's the thing. I took about 3 years off, because I went through some personal things with my family. And the last time I did the show was 2015. And then my mom got sick, and I went down a year later in 2016. But there was always something in my gut that didn't sit right with the show because I put too much heart and soul into it. But Anthony called me up, I think it was 2017. He goes, hey, he'd been trying to get it here for 10 years in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Rep, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, he got a hold of David Cesarini from Next Act Theater, and he goes, we're on. So then I was waiting and waiting, and then I just sat there, and I talked to my mother, my brother. Then my mother came back from Italy this past September, and she goes, you have to go and finish what you started 20 years ago. I give you my blessing. I called Anthony up, and I says, guess what? I'm coming to Los Angeles now. And It was wonderful. We ended up getting into a White Fire Theater.
One act festival.
And then we did a little run at the Zephyr Theater where it all started 20 years ago.
The same exact theater.
Yeah, and now we're here, which is nice.
Yeah, for a long time I had pitched it to several different venues in Milwaukee, and I kept on searching because this is one of the first times I've stepped on the other side of the table being a director versus being an actor. I mean, that's, people know me primarily as being an actor and a singer. You know, but I've also done producing and I've also done some directing, too. And this one, this particular project, near and dear to my heart for a myriad of reasons. And one of the reasons near and dear to my heart is because of the definitive Italian Sicilian roots that are in this piece. I wanted to bring it back for a myriad of reasons to my hometown and have my friends, have my family. You know, the dear friends I have on the east side of Milwaukee, Brady Street, and, you know, St. Rita's. I went to St. Rita's on the east side, and I was at Pio Nono High School, then merged with Thomas More High School. I actually did 1 year at St. John's Cathedral. And then I also attended Marquette University. And so I've got so many friends here in a myriad of ways. And, I mean, I want those people. I want the Italian community. I want the younger generation, the older generation. I mean, I know that the old timers are going to relate to this because it is spoken in their language. The actor in this piece, Steve, speaks Sicilian, classic Italian, which is a completely different dialect. He speaks Spanish and English. And so we can cover a variance of, of bases. And I can't say enough how supportive the city of Milwaukee has been to me. You know, both of us are really proud of this piece.
Yeah. It's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and a lot of work in this, but it's I'm starting to see the fruition.
You know, he's and I'm introducing him to Milwaukee, and his right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He's staying at the Plaza Hotel.
Yeah.
On the east side. He is.
It's beautiful.
You know, exactly, and he, you know, like a couple days here, just a few things that I've shown Steve. It's going, man, this so much reminds me of Connecticut.
Reminds me of Connecticut.
East Coast,
the blue collar.
It's the same mentality.
Yeah, I love it. Absolutely. Blue collar people. You know, just.
Warm.
I grew up, you know. So there's a big connection. I'm really happy that I'm in Milwaukee, and this has finally come true after, you know, Anthony's been trying to get this in Milwaukee for the last 10 years. So,
well, thank you so much for bringing the show to the city of Milwaukee. I hope you have a great time.
Well, thank you. No. We're happy to be here. Yeah.
Anthony Crivello is a Milwaukee native and director of Hear What's in the Heart, now on stage at Next Act Theater. Steve Sciante is the star and playwright. For more information, head on over to WUWM.com.
And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Joy and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski and Bonnie North. Claudia Delgadillo is our intern and Michelle Matternowski is managing editor.
Jason Reavy is our studio engineer and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.